Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this Eric Gregory Awards reading. We have to thank the Arts Council who funded the festival, and their support for the whole festival is very important. And I also need to thank the Foyle Foundation for sponsoring this particular event. The Eric Gregory Awards have been running for 40-odd years, I think. They were started by they were funded by a philanthropist called Eric Gregory to support young poets. And every year, half a dozen young poets receive an award based on a submission of a manuscript which they make. The poets are all under 30. It's always a trip down memory lane for me for this, because I got one in 1982 when we got £1,000 each. This year they got £4,500 each. So it shows, yes, their work is valued. But don't ask them to buy a drink for you afterwards. It's run by the Society of Authors, and the awards are given out every year. This year we have four of the five poets who've won this year. The other poet was Andrew McMillan, who read last weekend. So he's not here, but we have the other four. I'll introduce them in turn. First of all, we're going to have Sam Buchan-Watts, who's born in London, and he's co-editor of the anthology series Clinic. His poetry has appeared in Poetry London, Ambit, Lighthouse, and The Best British Poetry 2013 and 2015. He studied English literature at Goldsmiths and creative writing at UEA, and he's currently working on a PhD in contemporary poetry at the University of York. His Faber New Poets pamphlet was published in April when he took part in a mini-tour of poetry festivals and venues, which he's been blogging about very entertainingly on the internet. And one of the Gregory judges, Carol Rumens, said of his work, "It's understatedly witty, thoughtful, and visually alert. These poems inquire into the unexplored crevices of everyday life and lifestyle, revealing unfamiliar significance and colour." So do you please welcome Sam Buchan-Watts.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here. Car game logic. For every statue we erect, we eviscerate space. For each road pinned down, some meaningful utterance is snatched like a fly from a room. Marquee tent or empty pool, slimy wet around the edges. The mole pays back for the molehill. You can't push matter out or to the side of a dream in a manner so slipshod. Whatever has come to be required is done or made regularly at no small cost. That air freshener is erected at a lewd angle from the dashboard and cooks its bleach-cold aroma. It costs the air a bomb. For all the modcon soundproof, there is a whoosh or hiss, like at any moment dry ice will creep out over dusty rocks in the reptile room. I ran short of things to ask my parents in a manner that suits them while making droplets jump the landmarks of the school run. To those we owe the awkwardness. Maybe soon we'll pass Stonehenge or the Angel of the North if one or both didn't only pop up willy-nilly if the map knew how to mark them. Or the Eurotunnel drill mounted at some point further along just beyond those hills, you're sure. Whatever has come to be required is done or made regularly at great cost, like dry ice in the reptile room. But the fields are bereft of things, even trees. Perhaps these sights were snatched like a fly from a room while the hush had become an argument. And it's not until we quiet again that we clock the car we're in is not in fact the thing we thought was moving. I've got a series of poems which are effectively made-up dreams. I'm terrible at recalling my dreams, but I know it's not always so interesting when people do recall their dreams. The poet Mark Waldron has got a good line in his new book of poems where he talks about the hideous banality of another's dream. So here is some hideous banality for you. The Loop. I dreamt of the centre, the distant clatter and growl of activity at the ends of its lifelong halls, halls men were afraid to walk down. One man slipped clownishly on a spill of milk in the waiting room. He didn't allow for its consistency, thicker than water. The tannoy played a clawing baby cry on loop, beneath which the men struggled to be reposed as they leant against vending machines humming modestly. The thought occurred that baby whales are unpleasant because they have to be. Otherwise a baby could die, even in a beige and crop society such as ours, untended. A squeaky toy rolled continuously beneath the chairs, nudging men's feet. Nobody willing to reach down and pick it up, each the most keen to make himself heard, each feeling nearly pregnant, with a notion of love and becoming, but wanting a tactile space between the cries, stark, like an idea, from their trousers to their lips, saying this noise needs to stop, please, somebody stop this noise. The dogs. My most cherished photographs transformed overnight into those of dogs. Big, horny dogs in their ripest years hogging the frame for themselves. Every last photographer's trick employed, so that even in the tacky studio where he couldn't focus, my dog, like a good dog, looks ever curious and propositional, baring his hunk of incisor at us, its nourished decay. In the more rough-cut alfresco shots with an arty contrast between negative and positive textures, my black dog merges with the dark or slides into a pond in such a way that dog and pond are seamless. In this dog world, one ear of my dog is serendipitously folded back forever, fixed there. And though the tawny insides appear knobby and esoteric, they indicate a constant alertness to any thrown ball or that he is newly ruffled from rolling in the buzzing grass. There is a choice photo stashed in my wallet, its creased folds powdery with friction. His profile is divine against a backdrop of swirling marble blue. This day I recall for its stressful hilarity. We could not bundle his legs onto the stool. Since then the dog has been as mute as the pictures. Perhaps somewhere in his cropped out lower throat, his bark is stuck. My next poem was written as part of a back-and-forth exchange with another poet. We were swapping poems, and this was the prompt was memorialization. You just know that boundaries exist to be tested, and everyone knows, because you won't shut up about it, that the boy on the back row of the coach coming home from Ypres needs to masturbate, and is going to have to wait at least 4.5 hours to tame the snake, and the only way to get in the flat-headed straws of sherbet is to bite them, which is, of course, crude as having a password for the sweet deal for those coming back from Ypres. And the road to Calais seems to bend indefinitely, and the coach chucks itself and the weight of the lives of these kids at great speed, and is held between the oncoming reams of coaches on their way to Ypres and the rows of sugary trees pristine in their little collars of cable tie. And someone managed to get stoned, to bring with him the magnesium smell, and it's there in the corrosive tangerine of the tractor coughing smoke, ploughing fields of salted caramel, and which might veer off beyond them, threshing mounds of concrete, chewing up rats and benign snakes in the grass before plunging into delicately maintained bunkers and ditches, mangling itself on sewage pipes further down, emerging with a buck up, stupidly and heroically unseen, on the brow of a hill with a wistful crunch to say it's hard for a thing to stay immaculate except the glassy light of Ypres. I'll finish with this short poem. Which is called The Days Go Just Like That, which is something my friend said to me when he was describing his working life without any natural light. If you emerge from the glove of woods, the trail's patchiness like jaundiced spliff paper and the dry powder bloom of a fire extinguisher let off by kids last night, blinking, feeling skew-if, confused, to find this, a medieval reenactment in medias res, then you have seen it exactly as it should be seen, exposed but distant, so that the quirks, the radiant tinkle, the gathers of enthusiasts, the rhubarb rhubarbs, the unintelligible frills, the coarseness of sound their makeshift dress makes, like brown paper crumpling as it's being burned, are so correct as if history were a thing to be administered amidst the afternoon. And the hold-all blue seems about to decompress until all we have left is a far-off clobber of wood, and the days go just like that. Thank you.
I have some lovely comments on the poet's work by the Gregory judges. We don't actually have a comment by John Greening, who is here, who is one of the judges. But he assures me that he read all the poets, loves all their work, and has already congratulated them at the awards ceremony in London. The next poet is going to be Dominic Berry, who grew up in Biddeford in Devon and now lives in London, where he works as a copywriter in advertising. In his spare time, he manages front of house at Coffee House Poetry Nights at the famous Troubadour Cellar Club in Earl's Court. He studied creative writing at Kingston University, and his poems have been widely published in UK poetry journals, including Magma, Poetry Wales, Ambit and Iota, and in Best British Poetry 2014. He's been writing for 5 years and received a Gerwood Arvon Mentorship Award. He won the 2013 Magma Poetry Prize and edited an issue of Magma with John Stone on the theme Risk, which I imagine you'll hear in his poems. And Daljit Nagra said of his work that it's beautiful poetry of the British landscape that deepens with a focus on contemporary politics. So would you please welcome Dominic Berry.
Good morning. On the theme of risk, normally I launch straight in to the poems. But we had a conversation on the train coming up about Brexit. And I think regardless of your politics and where you stand on it, every generation feels like this, I know. It does feel the world is slightly disintegrating at the moment. And why I mention this is, I don't know if you've ever read Al Alvarez's Introduction to the New Poetry, where he talks about the gentility principle. And how we all have an assumption as English people that life goes on and people are more or less polite and that the world is more or less in order. And I suppose I don't normally theme a reading around anything normally, but I felt compelled to do so as a result of that. And the first poem I will read to you is called, it's the title collection of the poem, and it's Why I Have Chosen Not to Have Children. Please excuse the copywriter in me for that title. No part of me wants to remember the first time I felt it, dipping hands into the hen house to find each bird a cinder, each egg still scalding hot, but not yet hatched. Later, climbing fields to find cattle, womb furnaced, birthing the huge black colls of their calves, alive at least until the ash piles cool and the last cow splits. Even our midwives with oven mitts cannot calm our infants' new fevers. Softly they sing, knowing something else moves through them but the lymph in their limbs. I feel it too, but say nothing. Silence, my only comfort. Now I can hear drought knocking through the forest, each birch, each branch, each blade of wood, a time-sprung match. This is how we come to love only what will not kindle. The flax mud and the estuary still feeding the sea. The damp soil I press into my lover's mouth, pleading. Only the deaf and the eyeless still stand and signal for weather. I have heard thunder shake out the whole sky and bear none. And to think we thought the heron's song no warning. How we sold him all our rain and called him dumb. on the theme fire. Love, at noon, a bud, a vowel catching fire in my throat, and the school is bombed. Love, inform me. Love, forgive me. But in what tongue does a child keen as his street detonates? In which religion does he call mère, mamma, madre as he bleeds out? Say, this war is my final emptiness. My son kneels outside our opened house, watching the last cherry blossom split, petal by singular petal from the burnt trees, from his hands, love, his hands like a small bird molting. Yes, a wren in his fists, singing, then rupturing into flame. I carry him into the garden and press his body flat to it for him to see, to hear far off wild deer eating through the forest. On another continent, gracers glating their molars over the slats of the fjords. Look, I tell him, this was our world. Once. Listen how inside us still it continues, frozen and unclean, a creaking of wings, and his lids beat open, reflected in the black glass of his eyes, men on fire, hung like beacons in the rigging of the wood, their bodies like snow falling, their flaking bodies, snow, love, blossom falling. And the second two poems I'll read for you. I guess, I don't know if you've read the recent book of poems published by the Dickman brothers by Faber. It essentially is a collection of poems about their brother and about his personal struggles. And for me, it's really brought alive the ability of two men to talk so openly and so directly about this. Brother, they are still amazed, the surgeons, who had to perform my little brother's autopsy, still stunned to one by one peel back the spine to find in each small cavity not marrow but a seal of salt and grit, the blood in its return not leaving it, the salt still laying in the blood. Sorry, the residue still hot, but not leaving in the bone a single burn. They say he'd turn small fires in his sleep, that when he woke you'd hear, just for a moment, a crackling, that sudden hiss of magma dousing through the waves, the way the tide drags back to leave a mile of beach and sky still shifting overhead, an emptiness I couldn't believe. I couldn't help but shake the cockles from my little brother's skin, or take out from his throat the gull's eggs he'd attempt each night to smuggle in. Even the dock children, their eyes stubbed out, their hands one scab from hauling nets, began to notice how he'd stunk of ocean itself. How when he came back from the shore, there was more than boy left flapping in his chest. I still remember how I'd found whalebones hidden in the stoop, and in the loft one giant clam that held, clasped in its throat, what he'd later call his book of tides. This was the first time I'd attempt with my fists, my only gods, to beat the strangeness out of him. He wore then shadows deeper than the sea itself, but still he'd disappear for days to return changed, each time a little more unhinged. He thrashed and bit and spat. There is no line between the sea and sky. He'd said then in a smaller voice, no matter if you throw away the key, it will still come. I left him shaking in the dark until his skin had turned to moon and rust, his flesh so thin it showed not bone but each pebble of his spine, until one night I'd woke quite suddenly to hear waves knocking at the door, And from his cave, not his small voice, but a harsher cry, I threw back the door to find the whole room blown to sand and sky, how as I'd slept he'd called the whole sea in. My little brother opened then like a prayer, to show there not muscle but a length of weed, and with each fist I felt in my own chest each blow come back. Where in our bodies do we stall it, or that shame? How do we feel it as a knot, the gut all gone to rope, or how we sense only in the abdomen our loss? How when the surgeons took him out that last time to examine him, there was nothing in his throat. They'd said he'd choked on air itself. I knew the truth. And I'm going to end also on, I guess, a tribute to that collection. And it's called The Man Who Cried Wolf. Some lessons don't need teaching. My father, mute from birth, still passing on this one thing he could never fully name, but still at night gagged out. He, Gollum, he wore on each wrist his father's wounds to show without a word what true silence meant. An empty sky, first frost, a cuckoo's hollowed egg. And still I feel with each full moon his tongue rough in my throat, that one note turn like air to clay, then into this one cry, wolf, I call the word, I call until it hurts, I call it to the world. Wolf, the not the fang itself, but an excuse to find some noise, to mask the sound its teeth make in my skull. This word my father never could admit became at last the greater part of him. Why do we place into the dark what we cannot say but still live out? If you could hear him echo in my brain, the pain of ice that is the wolf break in me now, if you could touch the rips inside my skin and call them only braille, call me the wolf a lie, then turn your heads away as one. This is the common path, to pass the plea a man in pain makes back unheard. How do we learn from birth to dock the tongue, to bottle up the word that is the wolf, then make no sound, no noise at all, but still I call until it burns. Until it turns this voice, the claw inside of me. Until I hear not the wolf, but a child's voice break out from me. If you could see him curled inside my frame, the hood he wears, the stain that is the wolf, eat out the last of me, to leave only a little emptiness, a little rain. Thank you.
Our third poet, Jen Campbell, grew up in the northeast of England and now lives in London. She's the author of the Sunday Times best-selling Weird Things Customers Say in Bookshops series and the Bookshop book. She's also an award-winning poet and short story writer. This reading is my introduction to the work of three of the poets, but I have read and would highly recommend her pamphlet, The Hungry Ghost Festival, published a couple of years ago by the Rialto. And her collection in progress, The Girl Aquarium, is the manuscript which won the Eric Gregory Award. She's currently writing a short story collection, and her first children's book, Franklin's Flying Bookshop, is forthcoming from Thames and Hudson. She's worked in the book trade for 10 years and runs a YouTube channel and a monthly podcast where she talks about all things books. And she's currently a poetry judge for this year's Costa Book Awards. We please welcome Jen Campbell.
Hello. I'm going to copy Dom and say that we were having a conversation. We were those poets on a train having pretentious conversations about poetry and voice in poetry and how, obviously, through poems, you can tell very personal things and you can get across very raw emotion and the voice is often yours, but sometimes the I in the poem is not you, but we have that assumption to think that when a poet is talking and saying I, then they mean themselves. So the first poem that I'm going to read is called Kitchen, which is the first one in my collection, The Hungry Ghost Festival. And it's about two girls naked in a kitchen, and my mum is adamant that this is about me, and that when I was a teenager, I must have smuggled my girlfriend into the house when she wasn't in. And I've told her that it's not true, though it's amusing to let her think that it is true, because it drives her slightly mad, thinking that I broke very serious rules. So when she gives copies of the poetry pamphlet to her friend, she says, "This is Jen's poetry pamphlet. The first poem's not true." Which obviously makes them think it is true, which then makes my mum think maybe it is true again. And I'm a terrible daughter. It's hilarious. Okay, right, anyway, I'm going to read this one to you. "What would you do if I died right now, here?" you asked, your hand still resting on my thigh, your eyes focused on the ceiling, on the splash of curry sauce to the left of the light, which doesn't work. "We could have been in a field." "I thought it funny. Let's not talk of death where food is prepared," I said. You turned away, stood up, and opened the fridge. A light shone past you, the outline of you, your feet tapping on the floor. Your mother would be home soon, to her yellow and white check tea towels and a hand-painted bread bin and her naked daughter standing like Jesus in front of the refrigerator. I grabbed your foot. "Come on, your nipples will freeze and you'll be chronogenically frozen." There was a laugh somewhere under your hair as you toppled backwards onto the floor and cupped my face. "So if I died right here, now," you said, "you'd freeze me." Your eyes were grey, round, you were swimming, and I didn't know what you wanted me to do. "I'd keep you," I said. "I'd keep you right here, dead," you grinned, "where food is prepared." Well, then I'd eat you," I said. And you stared so deep, I drowned in a kitchen that wasn't there. "I'd swallow down all of the evidence of you." I grabbed your hand. We heard a key turn in a front door somewhere by the shore. "I'd like that," you said, and then kissed me. As Neil said, I'm originally from the Northeast, so sometimes I like to write poetry in a Geordie dialect, so that's what you're going to get now. And this poem is called Bird Lasses. "We'll get their souls, knock them down from downy birch, catch their spirits like, get them good. Out comes a spirit, sprite, dance in air, blackbird fierce out on the ground, yellow mouth, yelling quiet, nout. We'll net it quick, right? We'll tug it in. Have yous ever seen a birdish soul captured tight fist in a money box? It shines right, like your skeletons. It floats up on all we're tongues. I didn't know how we'll breathe it inwards, but we'll suck the life out through we're lungs. Let it settle on we're burning chests, chirrup on right through we're shoulder blades, feel we're spirits poking out we're fingernails. Out back, pull on bins for we're feathered tails. Stick some blackbird gloss in we're hair, tie we're new soles round we're necks. We can flap ourselves, pout out we're newborn beaks. Us as bird lasses, gannin canny fly, gannin cloudwards on we're own. The next one I'm going to read is the title poem of this particular collection, The Girl Aquarium. And when I wrote it, I gave it to my partner to read, who read it and said, "What the hell is wrong with you?" So you've been warned. The Girl Aquarium. At half term, the aquarium is at its busiest. They hire street vendors to come inside and hand out beer. Candy floss for the kids whose parents don't care. The corridors heave with barbecue. The air is too damp to strike a match. On the guided tours, there are labelled doors, tickets colour-coded for separate rooms, interactive exhibits, gas-powered lifts. Girls swim either side and finger the joints. Their handprints are broken like starfish. In the feeding rooms are girls with extra limbs. They scuttle into corners pretending they're shy. In the sunroom, girls with beetle eyes, iris headbands blinking at all the mobile phones. Hashtag girls, hashtag half girls, hashtag nothing you've ever seen before in your tiny little life. A young boy bangs the window and gives them the finger. The girls all rush forward, lips open, kissing the glass. The parents eat popcorn and miss their mouths while their headphones chatter on about science-based things. The girls wear numbers like netball jackets, glowing in the dark. In the purple room, there are floating body parts. When the clocks chime, these fly to meet each other, greet each other, humming choirs and muttered blues. An intern paints this behind a screen, singing underwater songs. The tanks in the basement house everlasting sperm. Small bottles of it sell in the aquarium gift shop. Mothers keep them hidden behind clocks, atop fires. Some bury them in their garden, hoping baby plants will grow there. A girl on Cecil Row prays her sunflowers will open to show bright blue eyes like her grandmother had. All the better to see you with. Thank you very much. Back in the central tank, pregnant women come to swim. They meditate beneath the waves and look through each other's skins. The water is thick with unpleasant wishes. Not mine, please yours. They sign contracts to give up their inner child, if. Most visitors do not choose to see the top floor birthing pool. Those who do bring dark glasses. They run their hands through their growing hair and count the strands. They place bets, sit cross-legged, counting kidneys, hands and teeth and toes. There is one man there pulling ice cubes from his pockets. This is not a competition, he shouts, but life makes you a winner. The women groan, lash out at his heels, their bellies upwards towards the sky like floating worlds. When it comes to it, they do not look. The successful few are praised and shunned. The unmothers wash themselves and hurry home, their hair still wet and bleeding. What the bearded lady told me. That she's never been called girl. That the word girl now sounds like a type of tree to her. That her mother grows trees in rows in their back garden. That she likes to count them, that sometimes she covers her face in paper, that she hates bubblegum, that she likes travelling if she doesn't know where she's going, that one day she would like to go whale watching, that she takes photographs inside her own head, that she likes to stretch her mouth wide, that she gave up on her legs such a very long time ago, that between her legs is volcanic, that men are terrified, that she loves how terrified they are, that she likes the sea, that there's a bus that goes past her house the colour of fists, that she grows into shapes when no one else is watching. And I'm going to end with this short poem here called Movement. On the bus home, I think of all the constellations hiding under my skin. I think of the word vain and decide I don't like it. I think of you and how maybe you flit and fit within a different galaxy. I write in my notebook in code and think about gravity. I think maybe we're just both lost in the skins of human planets. Thank you.
Thank you. And apologies, over the page, I missed Aaron Warner's comment on Jen's work, which I'll just give you. A collection of work that fizzes with linguistic dexterity and original phrasing, moving between the demands of the extended stanza, the prose poem, and looser longline structures, Jen Campbell produces a distinctive and absolutely daring poetic space of her own, which you've just heard. And finally, Alex MacDonald lives and works in London as a civil servant. He's had his poetry published in Best British Poetry 2015, Poetry London, The Quietus, and Clinic, was shortlisted for the Poetry School Pig Hog Poetry Pamphlet Competition and highly commended in the Faber New Poets Scheme. He hosted a series of readings at the V&A Museum on independent poetry publishers and he was digital poet in residence at the Poetry School in 2014 and is editor of the online magazine Poems in Which. And Daljit Nagra said of his work, an intensive exploration of what it means to be truly offbeat and alive. So here goes, truly offbeat and alive. Alex McDonald.
Hope you guys are feeling alive. I'm going to start with something that I wrote last week. Dom's already mentioned it, but it does kind of feel... It's strange. Like in London, there's a lot... And whenever you go on the buses, there's lots of empty cans of this energy drink called Nourishment. And you never know that they're there until you spot one, and then they're everywhere. And I kind of feel that about, like, bad news recently. Maybe because that piece of bad news has affected a large part of the country, and then all you can kind of see is bad news. And I was, at the time of writing this, I was reading a lot of James Schuyler. Has anyone read James Schuyler? He's like this really great New York poet. And he has this line in one of his poems, which is, bad news is a funny kind of breakfast, which is the title of this poem. My phone is going crazy at night, lighting up with little nightmares, vivid and pithily recalled. The morning has important things to say. I ask the plug hole to speak up. It must be hard when the radio is full of voices and you have a hole for a mouth and more holes for teeth, speaking only when something moves through you. You're like me, a man of absences, I say to practically no one. How can the Christmas flute of the weekend be playing outside my window? I haven't been hungry for company or breakfast all week. In the evening, I watch a 3-hour film about a room of strange desires and men hiding in zones, trying to piece a past from drowned pistols and paintings of forgiving women. There was no happy ending, but it ended. There are no crazy people, but there is hate. My phone cannot dream, but I soothe it anyway, stroking its head and listening to its voices, saying back whatever I can. This is a poem about how living in London is horrible sometimes. Approached with acres of dismantled cars. I'm forever approaching a new place. The other day I arrived somewhere. On the TV it was a place of promise, of investment, of new houses, but it was broken. Mixed in with the ground were things that will not be broken down. What could rise out of this cake mix, I wondered. Back on the train, looking out of the window, I saw a scattering of debris that rose in places, some of which was very considered, a real curatorial commitment. I saw people poking around in the dirt, marking off squares, unearthing more items, forever evolving, blooming, you could say, but others wouldn't. An appreciation of real life. When I looked out the crazy window, I saw the world as it ought to be and bought an ice cream in the shape of a Halloween eyeball. I didn't check the season. Old friends jousted with outstretched hands, mortally wounding each other with stories, and the discarded wigs dried out on the bus stop roof. You can tell a lot about someone from their recycling, but there's a sorting code. Put this box next to these beer cans. It's practically a computer. It's basically anything. By this point of the journey, I thought of all the email addresses I've occupied, sitting on them like a glamorous toad. All the bins have wheels, and the roads have that memory haze, making soapy lovers of us all. We're all capable of great things. As Neil said, I'm a civil servant and have been for almost 10 years. And I don't know if any of you have ever been in like a civil servant office. But often there's like these sort of weird grey people that walk around and don't really know where they are. They're just sort of, I think, perpetually confused about their place of work. I don't know why, maybe because the buildings are often labyrinthine and horrible. But so this is kind of about them. Don't let me down, important spectacle. My drenched suit clings like old skin or a funeral mood. Tugging at it won't make me more comfortable or appealing in what is now my third speech to the board. It's May, and I dream of it ending. How a weatherman might dream of weather not represented by symbols. Everything relies on the photocopies I've handed out, grey deities held by hopefuls. What invites faith? That yeasty smell, a flower bed in soft earth, my love with guinea pig eyes sadly looking. As I shift my weight from my bad leg to my overachieving leg, my audience are adolescent boys at the front door, and Dad hasn't been home for some years. Will I give them the jacket colognes, the purple silks, the complicated futures from the city? I have seen tomorrow's forecast. It's clouds. The next two poems are after a Japanese, in the style of a Japanese modernist writer called Hagiwara, who just seemed like this really kind of cool but anxious guy who would walk around the countryside of Japan getting really frustrated about insects and like cityscapes, and how he always felt sort of like, oh, don't look at me. Like, it just seems very, very strange. He's a very interesting writer. And I was so taken with him that I thought, I have to try this out. These two poems are in the style of Hagiwara. Blossom of the Cul-de-sac. Cherry blossom, this was to be your destiny, to scatter your confetti on this conga line of wheelie bins, drunk in their invisible arms, at the entrance of this dead end. I must have been staring too long, because faces greeted me with smiles lit by birthday candles. They asked, what do you think you're doing? Ah, isn't it difficult to answer when neighbours stand together like pylons in their small front gardens, tethered by loose associations and thick black cables? Birds top the telephone poles and shine like spilled petrol, the forecourt mirrors. Those masts stand taller than you, gentle tree, as your petals rest on lumpy sacks like apologies. Graveyard at home. When cleaning my small home, I came across a graveyard of ladybirds. Their dry bodies I mistook for amber jewels. I am now rich with insect corpses. How funny that even inside these walls, with paintings of jungles I've never visited, and photos of the rivers of Europe I gave a passing glance, that a community of tragic husks congregated in the shade underneath my chair, asking nothing of me, lying on their backs, baring their eyelash legs. My heart is full of you, my previous tenants. Just got a couple more. This poem came from I was really confused as to what the word halcyon meant, and that people talk about halcyon days, and I realised that it's a sort of an archaic way of saying kingfisher. So I was like, oh, kingfisher days, that sounds nice. And I thought, oh, I'll write a poem with that title. And you'll never guess what, here is the poem. Kingfisher days. It's difficult to love with a well-thumbed mind, no matter how well his features rise out on nitrate paper or how he may lift me over his outdoor body. I deny myself the hypothetical situations. Even if I did escape, where would I go? We are thick in country. Shirtless, he looks for dead leaves and he puts them in my hand like he's paying me for a day's work. Packing away her child's toys, my sister said that I need to listen to myself more and her wind-up phone with a smiley face is broken. All I seem to do is drink milk from my favourite glass, which is once a jar of fig jam. When he came home, finding me naked in the greenhouse, he was quiet in his oversized shirt. He was somehow in there. I'll find some standing water in a field leading to a floated meadow. Here I can give myself an image of someone like me breaking with light, the hurried bodies of nature behind me arriving, then leaving. I've just got two more. For a while, I tended to, when I was meeting friends for lunch or dinner or whatever, any occasion in which you have to meet someone, I tended to be really early, or people tended to be much later, so I just spent a lot of the time just kind of aimlessly wandering about, like, or sitting by myself in like restaurants, and this is kind of about that. Forever watching love grow. Something is flourishing in this waiting, the still seat opposite, my boredom. Punctuality is something you appreciate late in life, when friends turn to tree stumps and the underfloor heating is all hard water. I wish I could grow a beard to make your arrival more regal, or at least a joke about how long I have been sitting here. Each minute is greener than the next, your face in strangers. That bowl of flowers looks so familiar. I will not eat but debone each thought, looking for the darker meat, uncooked blood. My wooden restlessness. I have ordered water 6 times and see the dirt collecting on the floor. I wonder if we even made plans. Did I force you to feed the birds? I've looked longingly at your seat the way others look on travel websites. I feel the heat on my back and all the salads are growing warm. The restaurant lights go off and inevitably I'm lifted from you and I didn't even need to say anything. This is my last poem. Thank you so much to Ledbury and Neil and everyone that's been involved in putting this together. It's such a night. It's just really nice to be here. And thank you just for coming. And other things as well. My last poem is... I don't know if you guys remember this, but there seemed to be like a period of time where there was always like cassette tape or videotape in trees, like in amongst the branches. And I remembered this the other day, and I was like, a couple of months ago, I was like, what the hell was all that about? Like, I have no idea what that was. So when you type videotape in trees into Google, this really odd website comes up, which is called Update on Occult Activities. And it's written by this person who is really, it seems like sort of paranoia, schizophrenic kind of thing, where anything is taken to be some sort of signal of a malevolent force, which some of which I address in the poem. And there was this incredible line that was italicized and written in red, which is the title of the poem. What the darkness is doing is always the secondary issue. New things in the church trees, this time videotape. It knocked a bird's nest out. It's bad, definitely demon. Afternoon and it's hot, very hot. Dangerous road bend near my house and a bag is tied to a bush. Sudden breeze, then it's in the air. It waved over to me, then over traffic. On one side the bag said, big savings. Further reductions on the other. My dog is a good dog, nice face. I don't have much to say to him. I got home and he wasn't there. A hole in the door, dirty boy. Open the paper, the same children with the pains, cars on fire, and then the adverts are there again, recruiting the curious for paranormal research. Went walking. I saw chocolate, empty box of chocolate. It said black magic. I thought of the past, of the plastic coiled snake outside the farmhouse. I used to sing there. We had moved to this place. I thought, yes, safe. But no, the same again. The broken glass in the dirt. The leaves with cut-out smiles. It's almost winter now, and it's better. It's better, and it's just me. Sometimes the dog, and the darkness. And the messages under rocks. Every so often the woodlice forming words. The slow voices always. Thank you.